I can tell you that my brain is actually not quite to par today, so don't be surprised if I like go off on a tangent for some reason. I've been sick this week. So we are on lesson 9, and we are finishing up James 4, just the little part that we didn't finish last time, and going into James 5, which, you know, every time we've done this, every time I've had to stop the lesson where I thought, or earlier than I thought it should, it always ends up being better in the next section, that it fits better. So obviously God knows what he's doing, and I should not always think, oh, I've got to rush through. So I just want to remind us that we've been talking about our minds, how they need to be integrated with attention and attachment and emotion, and that we all have these stories of shame we've passed down from our ancestors, but that we all also, this is interesting, we also have this opportunity as priests to interrupt Satan's story, to interrupt those shame responses in each of our lives. And I hope that we have begun to understand what a privilege that is, that we can interrupt one another's Satan stories, those shame response stories. And today particularly, we're going to really get to the place where James wants us to get to. Remember James, do you remember what the biggest key word in James is?
Brethren.
He's really all about community. That is James' whole focus, is that a follower of Christ cannot live independently. That it is an anathema to think that you as a follower of Christ could ever live independently. And that means independently just you and God. James would just be so upset for anyone to think that. And that's what he's trying to get through to the recipients of his letter. Particularly because, of course, he's going into the Roman Greco world that is all about getting yourself the status, and that status is always an independent status. So for us to understand that we have the privilege to interrupt that story, that shame story, and remember, all of our shame responses, all of them are independently run, so that our contextual languages are all about us being independent. There isn't a single one that isn't. So to interrupt Satan's story actually incorporates us incorporating into the community, but also inviting others into the community as well. So we said that some of the ways that we can help interrupt Satan's story in others' lives as well as our own lives is by being quick to hear other stories. Hear other stories. So that's paying attention to others' value to the community. So not just value their value as an individual person, but their value to community. And that's very different. I would say that there's part of our society today that talks about valuing each independence and valuing each person as they are. But that's not what James is talking about. James is talking about valuing everyone's value to community. And we don't talk about that in society here. And that's something that's very different within the Christian world that we should be forefront runners of. And I'll read you an article that's really sad to think that we don't do that. So paying attention to others' value to the community, paying attention to others' needs, so that we create space for attachment. We also talked about being slow to speak in our words. We talked a lot about paying attention to our words as teachers. Whether you're a teacher of the word or not, you still are teaching God's story, or you're teaching Satan's story. And I think that's really important for us to realize, that our words do teach a story. No matter where we are or what we're doing, they teach a story, and they teach one of two stories only. There are only two stories out there. But also to pay attention to the power of our words. Remember, we talked about how much words can last. Up to decades for people. We remember words that people spoke to us, or maybe words that we spoke to somebody else. Just thinking about that makes me not want to talk. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just makes me realize, what words have I said that somebody is carrying around now? Mm-hmm. And that really touches my heart to realize, boy, our words have a lot of power. But also to pay attention to the heart of our words. In other words, the source of our words is God's story. And he's asking us to be good translators of his words. Not just the black and white words, but the emotion that is carried with them, the love that he has for every individual. Do our words carry that? Do our words carry that story that everyone is absolutely loved by him? So we talked that's what it means to be slow to speech. So it doesn't mean not talking at all, but it does mean taking the time when you're talking with someone to pause and say, are my words translating God's feelings and words to another? Are my words going to be words that are going to be carried forever? Just taking that few minutes. It's interesting, if we take the time to do that with our words, we will speak a lot less words, right? But as some of you have found, most of us don't give people time to do that, right? Mm-hmm. We want an answer right away, and if we don't get an answer right away, what do? We just jump in, right? We don't like that space. But James says we're the ones to be cultivating that space. So keep at it. And today we'll talk about that patience that we need to do that. All of that, our words are there to in order to create a secure place for attachment. You know, if you know people whose words are always critical, whose words are not telling God's story, but Satan's story, all about independence, if your words and I think one of the worst is if your words are blessing and cursing. If your words are, sometimes they're being really sweet to you and they're talking horribly about somebody else. How do you feel in the presence of that person?
Uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, yeah. Right? Yeah. And not trustworthy, right? Mm-hmm. Right? You know, you better watch what goes on there. And we need to think about that as well, because our words are meant to make a secure place for attachment. And when we have words that are blessing and cursing together, when we have words that are just always critical, always negative, it doesn't make a safe place for people to make attachments. Lastly, we talked last week about being slow to anger, and basically in our thoughts, because then it comes out with anger. We need to pay attention to the source of our anger, and the source of our anger is always our pleasures. It's always our lust. It's always our contextual language. That is where anger comes from, that we have a contextual language, that we say life is about this rather than relationship. So that's where our anger comes from. And remember, we're talking about orge anger here, not righteous anger. But we also need to pay attention to how it manifests itself. Remember the four ways that anger manifests itself? Can you remember?
Fighting.
Fighting. So that's the most obvious. When people are angry and they fight, right? They literally just battle you with their words or sometimes physical. That's the most obvious, right? What was the second one?
Adultery.
Adultery. What does that mean?
Hostility to God.
Hostility to God. So what is that?
Was that the self-soothing?
Yes, it's self-soothing. So you're angry. You're not going to recognize it as anger. You're going to recognize it as you're not happy. You're not content. So you're going to self-soothe yourself by
eating
shopping,
internet,
watching TV. Those are all self-soothing things. And those are all anger manifestations. And it's important for us to know that because our society says that's what you should do, right? You should self-soothe. You deserve, right? You deserve. And that's a word that really tells us. That's what our society believes. We should be able to self-soothe. But that is an anger manifestation. And it says, what it does is right in front of God saying, you said this isn't good for, you said greed's not good for me? Too bad. That's really what's happening when you do that.
What's the difference with, because it's self-sufficiency as well, that internal, and I know we can get that confused with the adultery. Adultery is the external.
So adultery is self-soothing. Self-sufficiency is I'm going to make plans for how life is going to go, and I'm going to do it regardless of what's happening with other people. So it's I am going to make sure that life happens for me. So it's not as much as an escape as the adultery is. Adultery is much more escape. Self-sufficiency is I'm just going to make the plan, and I'm not going to consult anyone. I'm not going to think about what that means for anybody.
I don't trust
complete God.
No trusting of God. No letting other people in to help.
Okay. Well, here's a question. When you talk about like parents and, you know, when they put a child down and they go, well, they have to self-soothe themselves. Where does that create some of this, you know, in terms of...
That's an interesting, you know, it's interesting to read parental guidance stuff, because you'll have both sides, right? I know that the research out on soothing a baby, they say that you can't hold a baby in too much.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That just came out again.
That just came out. I just read it like last week. Oh. So
when you look at other cultures, the babies are strapped to them, you know, until they learn to walk.
Oh, that's interesting. I wish I would have printed that out. There's actually a movement, and I got to think of what it's called, attachment parenting, which is just that, just like they do in the old country, is they attach their kid. Mm-hmm. And we used to, I think they still have these, right?
Yeah.
They wrap them, but they basically take the kid everywhere with that. So
kids better be spaced out, though. How do you do that?
Like, well, they're months apart.
At least get 9 months.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I don't know the answer to that, Yolanda, except that, I mean, James is talking to us as adults. Self-soothing is not a way that we show the world God's story, right? So we need to pay attention to that. So where we were going to go from there in today's lesson is, so then how do we manage our anger? We don't ignore it, right? We can't ignore anger. Because our emotions are there for a purpose, for us to recognize what we're doing. Oh, I guess I didn't finish.
Judging.
So judging, I mean, that's an obvious one, right? Mm-hmm. Usually judging is internal. I'll just give you an example. And this is, so judging is where I go. And literally I'm doing it all the time. And it's so frustrating. So I've been sick, so Bill set everything up last night, and I come down and I examine everything to make sure that it's, you know, done how I want it to be done, and it's not. Mm-hmm. And so what has happened in my head? You know, why does he do this? Why this? Instead of going,
thank you for what you did.
Thank you, this is great. But I didn't say that to him. It's in my head.
Uh-huh.
And I'm saying little things like, doesn't he realize if you do this, you know? That's the judging.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, so I had to stop and say, okay, Jill, what are you angry about? What's going on here? You gave that shame response of judging to God. You had him bury it. You can't use that anymore. So that's what I had to do this morning, to get through that and realize this had everything to do with my contextual language. It had nothing to do with what Bill did. What he did was wonderful, and he did a great job of everything. And even I said, I'm not sure I'm going to have class tomorrow. He said, it's fine. Like, it's not that big of a deal. We can put it all away. So,
wow.
You know.
He was making space, like, for secure attachment.
Yeah, he was. And that's what I mean by, that's how ugly our anger is, even if it's internal. So, most of the time, nobody would say that I'm an angry person. Mm-hmm. But my judging says I am. Mm-hmm. So you're self-soothing, which I think is really common for women, that's anger, and we have to recognize that. So the question is, then what do we do about that? We don't ignore it. We need to pay attention to that, right?
Are you saying everyone has anger?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
For sure. Well, and I noticed that last lesson. I'm like, I wouldn't consider myself an angry person, but reading through these different responses, I'm like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
How do I respond when my will is bumped up against?
Like, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. Karen, would you say that you don't think that's true?
No, I just never thought about that.
You what?
No, I wouldn't say that. I just didn't know if you thought everybody or if it was just like some have anger and some don't.
No.
Well, I think we all think it's the fighting.
Well, we
one.
Think,
Right.
I don't raise my voice.
Right, exactly. Exactly. No. So a lot of times you will not identify your own anger. You might identify it as fear. So I would say there's half and half. And when you look at psych profiles and stuff, they'll say that they'll divide it into three sections. They'll say fear, anger, and shame. But in truth, it's all shame, and it manifests itself as fear, anger, but it's all anger. So fear is just the fear of saying it's angry. but it is all anger. So they're all anger manifestations. And I think that's something, you know, and here's where, listen to this. I'm judging again, but I read something the other day about, you know, a review on the shack. And the review was, you know, when we pull in psychology with our theology, you know, with all this, you know, how bad it is, and you've just got to have this theology that says this is the right way to go. And of course, I'm getting angry. Like, you can't say that. You can't. You want to ignore the pieces of our beings that God has made, emotion. You want to ignore that, and you're losing everybody because you can't ignore part of our being. So I judge part of that, and I realize I was very angry as I read this, thinking, I'm so tired of hearing people dismiss pieces of our beings because it's not theologically correct. Yeah, well, I think James talks to it, and I mean, he talks to it loud and clear. If he's talking about anger that doesn't achieve the righteousness, doesn't achieve relationship, right relationship, then we need to be talking about it as well. So,
Jill, would you think, I kind of think that people, the reason that people do that, like with the echo, is probably because the pendulum swung so far this way that they're trying to correct it, but in correcting it,
they go too far.
Black and white.
I absolutely agree.
Because of the fact that it's gone too far, that's what's like, no.
Yep.
I think it's so interesting that the shack came out now. As we're studying this, like in my head, I'm like, oh, because I went to see it, I read it, and I'm like, this is what we're talking about.
I know.
Constantly. Mm-hmm. It just was so cool to me. And it helped me, just reading about how the different parts of God interacted, to me, I wasn't here, so I missed this last week's lesson, but to me, I kept thinking, oh, that's how I want to be. Not angry, not upset, always loving. Like, it was just what you were talking about.
Yeah. So what we have to remember about how the mind works is that we have these neural pathways, right? And we've practiced the shame responses, those angry manifestations, over and over again so much that that has become our primary story. And that primary story has a thickness to it. In other words, the neural pathways have been used so often that they're very thick and used very much. It's like a rut in the road, that's where you're going to go. You know, it doesn't matter how much you try to get off of that road, you're going to fall into that rut again. That's what's literally, physiologically, that's what happens with your brain. Now, we can try to put in lots of different other ways of thinking and ways of doing it. If somebody says it's not good to be angry, you should do something else. You should, you know, forego being angry. You can try it, but most of the times those neural pathways will just die because they're not used over and over and over again. We can, though, they say that you can have secondary stories. And this would be my guess at what happens. The secondary stories is usually when you've heard about Christ and what he's done for you. That would be a secondary story. And you hear it over and over again, and it becomes a secondary story for you. But what we need to understand is we have a primary story that we have had since we were born, even before we were born. We've had that. So that the fight against that primary story, in order to get that secondary story switched, it can be switched, but it will take a fight. It will take a lot of resistance from going from that primary story to the secondary story, so those two switch. And we need to understand that physiologically so that we understand really what spiritual warfare is. And that's really what James is all about. James is about spiritual warfare. The fact that our minds need to be able to resist the story that we've grown up with. And although every one of us here has Christ's story, we haven't all made it our primary story. And we don't even talk toward that, right? We just, and this is where I got angry with that article. It was basically saying, just tell them the good news and that's it. It's just information. And the problem with that is, and we've done this so much, just say the prayer and you're good. The problem is the brain doesn't work that way. So what are we going to do with a brain that is still on that primary story of life is about some independent language?
Do we reteach it?
Well, that's what we talked about, right? We need habits, right? We need to be able to employ habits that continually retell God's story so that that becomes the thicker pathway. And the more so that's what we're going to talk about today is what it means then to get rid of that the anger, to deal with that anger and allow God's story to be that primary story. So that's what spiritual warfare is allowing God's story to be the primary story and allowing Satan's story to be the secondary story and eventually to die out. Okay, so that's where we're going with what James is talking about here. So back in 4, when he talked about, and interesting enough, the way James wrote this, notice that he did, we've done enough of these words. This is a chiastic structure where he did James 4, and he gave you two anger manifestations at the beginning, and then he gave two anger manifestations at the end of chapter 4. And in the middle of chapter 4, he talks about what it means to submit to God. So that's our first key to understanding. So that's whenever a writer does that, whenever a writer separates things he's talking about and right in the middle puts something different, that's the highlight, right? That's the focus of where he wants you to focus. So what he wants us to focus on is how is it then that we make God's story our primary story and allow Satan's story to lose its primary position in our brains and in our minds? He says that we are to submit to God. In other words, we need to live submissively in God's story. Now, what does that mean? I need a volunteer. Somebody want to volunteer for me?
Sure.
Lord?
So, I want you to think about...
am I moving?
You're moving. You're coming up front.
Is that a cape?
Jose loves dress up. She might break in to let it go right now. she's done that like in a large area. So.
Okay, so
oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
There you go.
All right,
nice.
You are Elsa.
Did you get him?
Now,
yeah, this is super cool.
What does it mean to submit to God's story? For Laura Jean, what does it mean to submit to this, whatever this represents? She right away said, what is it, Frozen, yeah. Right? Oh. What does it mean for her to submit to that?
Let you put it on.
Let me put it on. Anything else?
The identity of...
Yeah. And so what is that going to mean? So what did you first start to do?
Same.
Girl. So go ahead.
Girl.
Do it. And now I want you to sing your little song there.
Oh, there you go.
Snow goes white on the mountains.
I told you.
And it looks like I'm a queen.
That's great.
I didn't do the let it go verse, too.
Let go.
I knew it.
Let go.
So for Laura Jean to submit to the story of Frozen... She completely changes character, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she allows this to define her. And she continues to... Now, I want you to stay in that for the rest of the day. Or at least for the way you're here. So what I want you to notice is what happens to Laura Jean. If she continues to stay in this, does it change the way... She moves her body. Does it change the way she speaks? Does it change the way she sees things? In other words, does it change her perspective? So just like anyone who is, how many of you have ever acted in a play? So you know that when you act in a play, right, you don't bring yourself to that play so much as you allow that character to overtake you, right? And you become that character. That's what James is talking about when he says submit to God. Submit to God's story. Let God's story overtake you. So that as Laura Jean sits there as, what is the Frozen girl's name?
Elsa.
As she sits there as Elsa, if she is submitting to that role of Elsa, everything she does will be Elsa's story, not Lord Jean's story. It's the same thing that Paul says, for I no longer live, but it is Christ who lives in me, right? It's Christ's life that I'm living. And yet, for some reason, we have come up with the idea that when we become believers, we are here, and Christ has come here, and he's given us eternal life. But we forget the fact that we put him on, that we actually become, allow his life to live out from under, from within us. John talks about that he's going to give the Spirit that within you will bubble up, so that if I'm submitting to God's story, the Spirit will bubble up from inside me and be let out. That's what it means to submit to God's story. And we'll just keep an eye on Lord Jean and see if there's any difference about how she submits.
She has to sit down. She has to, like, pull it up to sit down. Like,
exactly.
It changes everything about her movement, too.
So that she's very aware, right, that she's wearing Elsa's cape.
She may spill on me.
That's right. There you go.
You.
Literally. And
right. Exactly. Exactly. And so... And, there wouldn't be anybody that would walk into this room and not notice that she's wearing a white cape, right?
Sorry, I got to do this for Sue and Janice.
You should have taken pictures and singing.
There we go.
So I want us to think about that picture of when God, when James says submit to God's story, it means that we begin to live in his story, not just that we know his story. And I think this is where we often make a mistake, is we think we're just supposed to know his story. But James says we're supposed to submit to his story, that we actually begin to live it. It's why I gave you those meditation practices, because I want you to begin to live his story. I don't want you to take his word. It's so precious, and I don't want you to think, oh, these are great stories. They tell me wonderful things, and they teach me a lot, but it's not my story. This is my story. For you to take his word as my story means a whole different thing than you knowing. You could be the best Bible scholar, you could be the best theologian, and tell me exactly what everything means here, but having not taken it as your own story, it means nothing. It means nothing without this being your story. Yes. So that's what it means to live submissively in God's story. And here's the cool thing. When you live submissively in God's story, that in itself is resistance to the devil. That's the resistance. That's why it says, submit to God, resist the devil. Same thing. It's the same thing. We don't think of resisting the devil as something you have to go out and do, as much as you resist the devil when you submit to God's story. So that looks a lot differently, doesn't it? It's not quite as difficult as you think, but submitting to God's story means you're resisting Satan's story. The person you're sitting next to, I want you to take your arm as if you're arm wrestling with them. So you two, the two of you. But I don't want you to set it on anything.
No,
just two of you together.
I'm really strong.
Oh, you can. So I want you to try an arm wrestle without setting your arm on anything. Go ahead.
What? Oh, wait. I totally gave it to you.
Okay. Right. So you're getting all your anger out. So what I want you to notice is it's very different than if you have a solid base, right? A stable base. So that when I'm resisting the devil, I've got to have a base of God's story. That is when I'm able to do it. So that when I'm sitting in God's story, the resistance becomes part of the living. I don't want us to think that resisting Satan is a separate part of our life. It is something we should be doing every day, in submitting to God's story. It is going against the current that he has set for us, that he's whispered into our ear and caused us, our attention to be distracted from that secure attachment. If I'm living in the secure attachment of God's story, and I'm continually practicing that, I am, in effect, resisting Satan's story. Does that make sense to you? Understand how that works? So that every time his story rears its head, if I've been practicing God's story, and all of a sudden I want to judge, or all of a sudden I want to fight, or all of a sudden I want to self-soothe, I can easily go to God's story. Wait, God is running toward me and holding me and saying, I love you, you're beloved. I no longer need to self-soothe, right? I no longer need to judge. But if I've not been practicing God's story, then I will go right back in that rut. And every time I go right back in that rut and I judge or I fight or I self-soothe or I become self-sufficient, every time I go back in that rut, what am I doing?
Retelling
that old same story, and I'm making it even stronger, right? Deeper, a deeper rut. So that tells you how important it is for me to submit to God's story, and how important it is for me to practice that. So the Protestant Church has done away with practices for the most part, and I think that's to our detriment. Mm-hmm. I think that we have lost the idea of practicing things that will allow us to easily go back to that. So we've become, and part of it is because of how society's come, we've become a religion of the head. Yes. I don't care how many times you say it's about my heart. We've become a religion of the head. Whereas the habits that we have are the things that really shape us, really help us to go back to that. So I don't know if I should ask how many of you are continuing to do the meditations. I'm telling you, they really are helpful to do those. And I would even suggest, begin to come up with some of your own. They're not hard. You go to the Gospels, the four Gospels, take one story of Jesus encountering a person, make it your own, put yourself into that, and then find a psalm that responds to that. It's very simple, but it's helpful for us to be able to do that. So, James 4 says, one of the ways that we submit to God is that we draw near. So in drawing near, what that does is resist Satan's story by pushing away the distraction of our contextual language. And how do I draw near? Just exactly what we've been talking about. We move to a practiced experience of God's story, so that we are listening to God's story daily. I don't know how much more forceful to say, we must be listening to God's story daily. I don't mean we must check off the list, we read our devotion for today. Mm-hmm. It's not what I mean. I mean listening. All those steps we talked about, listening, being silent before him, allowing your story to be in there, that whatever you read for your scripture in the morning or whatever you do it, that you put yourself in there, mm-hmm. that it isn't an informational packet for you. That it is actually him telling your story in his story. Because those then become the places that you can go to when you find yourself judging, when you find yourself fighting, when you find yourself self-soothing. You can go to those places. And it becomes easier and easier the more you've practiced those places where you put yourself into God's story. The more you practice that, the easier it is to go there when you come up against your own anger. And remember I told you what happened to me with the vision that God gave me about burying my shame. That's what you need to do. You need to allow him to bury your shame. So was everybody here last week? Side? Okay. So remember my vision of, so I had when I was passed around as a baby, and then Jesus throwing me up in the air. The other week, during worship again, I had another vision. And, I've had visions throughout my life, but it seems like I'm having them all the time now. I saw him. I did my meditation where I went into the rooms and tried to find my self crying. and I found myself crying. And I didn't know what to do with myself. And Jesus came, took myself as a little baby, and wrapped me in, so you'll know because you saw the shack, wrapped me in burial clothes. And when he did that, he took me, and I followed him up to his throne, and he buried me in the throne. And I said, what are you burying? And he said, my shame. And I said, my shame? No, your shame response of judging. And I had recognized, and I said, what shame response? So he made me, he said, go back down to that house that you went into, my grandmother's house. And I saw myself being accused by my mother as a seven-year-old of stealing some money, which I hadn't done. She had lost it. But she accused me and said that she was going to take me to the police station. And I immediately, as a seven-year-old, said, that's it. I'm building the wall between me and you. You're not for me. And what Jesus said is that response, I'm burying that. You're not using that again. You're not going to use that building a wall again. And that's been really helpful for me because it made it real for me. I've always known I've done that, but it made it so obvious, like that's not an option anymore. So that when I begin to do that, I go right back to that story. Wait, and that's what happens when you do those meditations, is you begin to let God really infiltrate your own stories and to be able to see what's going on there. So that's what it means to draw near. Chris.
I've been doing those meditations, and one thing that I really have found interesting is, especially in the one where you're going back into your childhood, it's like all of these things that I've been, kind of experiencing in that, it's like they've been there and I've known it. But it's like to move forward, you have to really process through it. Mm-hmm. And instead, it's been like, okay, but, I have this new life, in God, I have this new story, but I've not really processed right. that in the past. I just went, okay, right. It's not me. But really, I haven't moved forward in some ways.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I've been kind of realizing for myself. It's helping me actually face some of those things
yes.
that I just not really wanted to face.
Yes.
I just wanted to move forward.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, and I think that's part of the, it allows God to go in all areas of your life. Mm-hmm. It allows him to go into those areas that you've kind of shut off, like, mm-hmm. well, that's not me anymore. Well, that's true, but you haven't dealt with that. And we'll talk about mourning those kinds of things. We have to do that in order for us to actually mm-hmm. embrace God's story for us, because otherwise we just carry it through and we just hide it.
You know what this is reminding me of? I don't remember if it was Covenant or which study it was, but you had on Lissa's white jacket mm-hmm. and then you put on, the lovely white coat over it representing God's identity, but with your own identity on under there,
yes.
it was like bulky, and so part of that is stripping that
yes.
old identity
yep.
and then resting comfortably in
right.
his. And
right.
just making, that was such a great
yeah.
visual and
yeah.
just reminding me.
Yeah, that it's funny because I actually was going to get rid of that coat and I decided, oh, I can't because I use that. And it's one of my
oh, really?
Favorite coats, yeah. But yes, that's part of it because you'll keep that with you. If you don't deal with it, you'll keep it with you. And have God's identity and you'll be using God's identity, but there will come times that it becomes uncomfortable and hot and like, pretty soon, the thing you're going to strip off is God's identity because yours is still there. Mm-hmm. So that is part of that.
Can I ask you a question
yeah.
about them? So I've been doing them too, and I have a difficult time with the one that's looking. I can see me as a kid.
Uh-huh.
I cannot find me in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing it for weeks. And the interesting thing is when I pull out of it, I immediately go to the prodigal son story, mm-hmm. and God holds me every single time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And it's and I don't know why, but and yeah. I'm doing it. I'm choosing to go there. I'm like, I'm complaining. I'm like, I can't find me. It's okay, Michelle.
Yes.
It's so great to be with you. Like, that's always, and I just stay there.
That's
like, okay, then I'm not going to force it.
That's right.
I think
right.
the reason I say this is because if anyone else is having a difficulty, I think that's part of the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
That mm-hmm. it didn't come like yours is.
Right.
It's like much
right.
slower.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm waiting.
And that's true. It comes much slower because remember, I've been working on this for a long time.
Yeah.
So, and it is more my bent. That's where I've always gone to. But the funny thing is, it may come to you like out of blue, or you won't know. But most of all, we need to understand that we do have a story that we tell ourselves and we won't admit to it. And we've got to get to the point to say, no, I do have this shame story somewhere. And I have a story that I actually live out of that isn't always God's story. And so James wants us to practice God's story. We need to practice it. We can't just... The informational gospel is really frustrating to think that that's what we're giving... that's what we're handing out, is this informational gospel that if we just know it. And our brains don't work that way. So... Anyway, that's what James wants us to know about drawing near. And part of the drawing near, what James 4 and 5 does is reflect James 1, is do exactly what James 1 has said, is ask for wisdom. Mm-hmm. Remember, ask for God's Holy Spirit to participate with you. And how do you learn how to be by watching him participate with you? Ask for wisdom as you're drawing near to him. He goes on in 4. So that is where we had James 4, 8, draw near to God. Draw near to God. Then it says, cleanse your hands and purify your hearts. So this is, remember, and what you should see there is, submit to God, resist the devil. It's the other side of the same coin. Then he says, draw near to God, cleanse your hands. Both, one coin, same sides. So as I draw near to God, the same thing, I'm cleansing my thoughts, my words, and my deeds. And that resists Satan's story by making my contextual language unavailable for use. So how do I do this? I actually throw out those shame responses. This is why it's so important for us to identify our shame responses, because I need to at some point name them and refuse to use them, refuse them as possibilities for me to use. And in that, I need to refuse the actions I use for that, the thoughts I use, and the words I use. So, if I usually judge, then watch yourself. The next time you judge, or the next time you self-soothe, watch yourself. What are your actions? What kind of actions do you do? When I judge, do I, like, stand back from somebody? Or do I cross my arms? What do I do with my body? What do I do with my words? So remember, for judging, that's mostly internal. Although it will eventually come out in our words. But what are my words to myself? Take those and say, those are the words I usually say. Those are not available to you anymore. Christ has buried those. Those are not yours anymore. They don't belong to you anymore. Stop using them. And the same with my thoughts. So I need to reject creating separateness. And all of our anger responses create separateness. I need to be able to reject those. In order to reject them, I need to name them. So I need to be able to identify my shame responses, my anger manifestations, and be able to deal with them and remember that Christ has buried those. They don't belong to you anymore. He then goes on to say, be miserable and mourn and weep. So in order for us to mourn those, first of all, what that does is it resists giving space to let it go. In other words, Satan doesn't want us to have space to think about that and to let it go. But in mourning, it actually makes space for me to let it go. So I'm sure you've always heard of people who have lost a loved one and they've not had anything, right? They haven't had a funeral or a wake or a memorial service, and they have a very difficult time ever really grasping the reality that their loved one's gone. So that you might see things like they keep the room of the loved one intact, they still make lunches for them, or whatever it is that happens. Or somebody who has lost their leg, and they refuse to admit that they've lost a leg. And so what happens? They actually try to use it, right? And they fall. That's what it means to mourn those things, those shame responses as losses. They were a part of us for a long time. We actually need to mourn them. And I think it's interesting that these words here, miserable, mourn, and weep, I can't remember which one. One of them is an internal mourning, and one of them is an external mourning. James says we actually need to externally mourn those shame responses. Why do you think that is?
Release.
Right? We're embodied, right? Nice. Yes, so we're integrated. So we have to have, our body has to be involved in this. So this is something we definitely, Western culture doesn't do, right? Mm-hmm. We just don't, I should say Western white culture does not do. We don't allow ourselves to physically and vocally mourn our sin. That really puts us at a disadvantage because our body needs to have that physical manifestation of mourning. We've lost something. We have had this, I've had this judging shame response for years. And I, as I let go of it, Christ got rid of it a long time ago. I'm still the one hanging on to it. But I need to mourn it. And I've gone to that place where I've wept. This is part of me, and I'm now letting it go. And I need to mourn that loss. Not because it was something good to keep, but because it's a loss. Because it did actually was part of me. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Okay. That, I think that's an important piece of that we need to understand. So that when you're doing your meditations, when you're working through your shame responses, to allow yourself to do it vocally, to allow your body to work through that.
When we were in Ethiopia, what was interesting, our hostess had taken us down into the selling part of the city. While we were there, a hearse went by, and we kept hearing from a distance, we kept hearing this noise, and it just got louder and louder, and realized all these people were following this hearse, and they were screaming and crying, and we found out that the day before, this 12-year-old son had fallen on a rock and died suddenly. It was like he hit his chest so hard that he died, and they were mourning this 12-year-old. This man was mourning because they were saying, of course, we couldn't understand, but the host said, they're saying, my son, my son, my son. Mm-hmm. And he was following this hearse. And I thought, you know, that was really, to me, it wasn't, these weren't like paid mourners. Now, mm-hmm. I understand that sometimes there are paid mourners, but I really felt like this was the real deal.
Yeah.
Because he was yelling, my son, and it said just the day before, you know, this had happened.
Yeah, so we know that in all other cultures do this, right? Even here, where do you hear people mourning?
On the TV news.
And who's doing it?
Black.
African American.
Mm-hmm. Yep, because their culture says it's okay to do, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. That's really healthy.
That's where our songs come from, mourning.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So James says this is actually a necessity for us to be able to be integrated wholly, is to be able to mourn those losses. And the loss of our contextual language is a loss still. It doesn't matter that it was a loss that needed to happen. It's still a loss. And we do need to be honest before God to say, we've let it go and we're letting you bury it. We're going to watch you bury it. I think it would be very wise of you to be able to take one of your meditations and watch God bury your shame response. Name it and let God bury it. I think that would be a really helpful thing. Lastly, he says to humble yourselves. So this resists Satan's story by recognizing that we lack, that we're in need, and that life that is given to us is a gift rather than something I've earned, and I can't earn it. I can't get enough. So I need to recognize that the process of integrating God's story into my story, the process of submitting to God's story as my story, is a process, and it's a process of growth and intimacy, that I come into his presence and I lay all that down before him, that I'm very honest and say, God, this has been my shame response for years, and I lay it before you and I allow you to bury it, and I don't know how to deal with the times when I feel like my language is being bumped up against, my will is being bumped up against. I don't know how to deal with that. Can I watch how you deal with it in me? Your language is always being bumped up by me, God. I want to know how you deal with that. And that's that humble, like, I cannot submit to God on my own. I don't have that power. So for me to be humble before God and say, here it all is, I recognize all of this. And even in the recognizing, you're going to need his help, right? It's not going to just come on your own, and it's not actually just going to be doing the exercise. It's actually saying to God, I need your Holy Spirit to show me these places. So those are the things that James says is how we submit to God's story. When he goes into chapter 5, what he wants to tell us is, so there's the other side of the coin about submitting to God's story, as far as dealing with our anger manifestations, is living communally with God's story. So this is where James gets to the crux of the matter. Chapter 5, really for James, is like, this is where I've been going all along. I want you to make sure you know that your story is God's story, that God's story is your story. But I want you to do that within community. I want you to make sure that you're living God's story with others and that you're not trying to live God's story on your own, because that doesn't work. And what he wants us to do is to consider community as ourselves, that we are more than just us, that we are just an I, and all the other people we need just as much. I read a really sad article this week that talked about how we have, through the last couple generations, how we've lost the idea of community, and how we've lost instilling that in our children. The article came from original research that had found that religious kids, particularly Christian kids, are worse at community than the normal. Mm-hmm. So they did another research because they just didn't like that. To find out. This is how research happens, right? And so the second research found out, well, maybe that's not so true. Maybe it's just that Christian kids are just the same as every other kid. But that in the years, and I'm going to read you part of this, in the 80s and 90s, compared to now, kids, students, are less empathetic by a huge amount than they were in the 80s and the 90s. And that has to do with how they see community. So that when I'm submitting to God's story, I'm taking on his perspective, how I see myself. But when I submit to God's story in community, it helps me to change my perspective as to how I see one another, so that they're me. And what James wants us to do is to recognize that in the community of Christ, this is where we learn how to be community. So that when we go out, we know how to, if we're not acting like community here, how are we going to treat people who have no idea they belong in this community? This is where we have got to learn it. And James is adamant, you've got to learn community here and what that looks like. Let me just read you a little bit of this research. So they did this research and they found that the students' values seem to echo what they think their parents and teachers value more. When asked, 48% chose achievement as their top value. In other words, students see their top value as achievement because that's what their parents say is top value. 30% chose happiness, and only 22% chose caring as a top priority. So caring within community. Students were 3 times more likely to agree than disagree with this statement. My parents are prouder if I get good grades in my classes than if I'm a caring community member. Would you say that's true?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
About 80% said their parents are more concerned with their kids' achievement or personal happiness than whether they care for others in their community. And when asked, school administrators, teachers, and staff agreed that parents prioritize achievement over caring by 80%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The results of this study don't indicate complete disregard for others, but rather a limited regard. The study found that American adults do want kids to be decent and caring, especially in their immediate communities, but that they are far less concerned about a commitment to the greater society's well-being. So that idea of common good is gone. Mm-hmm. We don't have that anymore. Our conversations with and observations of parents also suggest that the power and frequency of parents' daily messages about achievement and happiness are drowning out their messages about concern for others. Mm. That's exactly what we were talking about, right? If that's what you hear all the time, It doesn't matter that your words have once, you know, as Christians, we have to care for one another. We have to care for community. But if you're hearing every day, how are your grades doing? Are you happy? I want to just make, you know, I hear this all the time, and I've been guilty of the time. You know, I really care that my kids are happy. And I'll be honest, I don't really care. And Bill and I sometimes argue about that because I don't really care. I do care that they love God and that they love their neighbor. That's what I care about. But that isn't, pretty much we go with, I care more about your happiness and I care about your achievements. And Christian would say that I have given the message that I care about his achievements. I mean, we've had this talk and that's been devastating to me. I think that's not what I wanted, but that's what I've conveyed because of habits, right? A glimpse.
I was going to say, I love it that some schools, I don't know, some high schools require so many hours of community service before the kids can graduate. You know, unfortunately, that wasn't true in the high school where I was counselor. So, but I've read it in other communities where that is a requirement. I think it should be in every high school.
Well, that helps, right? Except that.
It is forced. Well, it is forced, but it gives them a different perspective.
It gives them a different perspective, but it still has to be a practice practiced at home.
Sure.
Pat.
I taught in the Montessori school, and one of their primary principles was that they had special needs kids in their class because they wanted them to care for each other. And they also had farm animals because they were having the kids care for the animals and take care of the chores.
Yeah.
And so this was very much a part of the Montessori school. And it was really exciting because I saw we had one boy that could hardly walk and he couldn't talk and he drooled and, you know, he was like this. And they were doing some construction in the school and the dust made the fire alarm go off. And this kid went bananas. I mean, he was scared to death.
Of course.
And all of the other kids comforted him, and they almost physically carried him down the stairs and out of the building because they all appreciated, you know, that he needed some special care. I thought that was so good because the school was teaching to the kids.
Right. Every day, right?
Every day.
Yeah. So it wasn't just a,
It's not just us telling them to do it. It's
no.
They watch us do it.
That, right. And that's what it's, so that's part of the research was that it doesn't matter what the parents say. It matters what they do. And I don't know how many times we can bang this into our heads. It's the habits that we do with our bodies that make the difference.
I think that's starting to change, though, because I agree with you. A few years ago, it was very much academic focused, but as we engaged the community of District 203 in thinking about what they want for their students and what they want for what stood out above and beyond everything else was social emotional learning, which guides right into what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so just like in the last month, we've approved a whole curriculum K-12 with lots of resources and materials to go with it for social emotional learning because that is becoming more of a priority, even a priority into looking at how you gauge that and give feedback to the parents so that they can continue that learning, report card in a sense of standards for social emotional learning.
That's great.
So that is like something that, I think we were there like years ago, but it's starting to turn.
And
I'm excited that we're like on the forefront.
That's so great. Let me just finish this up. A glimpse back at 3 decades of data finds that American college students in 2009 were less empathetic than students in the 80s and 90s. Student scores on perspective taking, which is why I had talked about where we sit, because it changes our perspective, right? The ability to imagine others' points of view dropped 34% since 1980. That's a lot, guys. If you do any study, statistical things more than 10% is big. 34% is huge. Scores on empathic concern, the tendency to feel and respond to others' emotions, dropped 48%.
Wow. That's terrible.
And college students in 2009 were far less likely than their earlier counterparts to agree with statements such as, I sometimes try to understand my friends better by imagining how things look from their perspective. And I often have tender, concerned feelings for people less fortunate than me. I was very sad to hear that. I'm very glad to hear what Donna has shared with us, that we're actually beginning to address those. James talks about that's what the church should be doing. Mm-hmm. The church should be addressing these. But the church within our home should be addressing these, right? Mm-hmm. We should be addressing these, and which means we have to address it for ourselves first. We can't say that we can't go home, and this is what I would hate for any of you to go home and to tell your kids, now you need to be more concerned about your fellow neighbor. I want you to show it, right? James wants us to show it. So what he means by living communally with God's story is first and foremost exactly how God gives to us, we are to give to others, giving ourselves fully. So James does this by really getting you out of your seats because he starts yelling at you, basically. He says, what is the, come now, you rich. So he's scolding. He's scolding those in the church. Remember, he's speaking to those in church. You are hoarding your lives. You're hoarding them for yourselves. You are not concerned about others. You're not concerned about your workers. You're not concerned about the people around you. You're only concerned about yourself. You are hoarding your lives. When God has fully given himself to you, he's allowed you to fully know him. He gives you, remember that whole point of James 1 was God gives to us so fully. We are to do the same kind of thing and not hoard our life, but to give ourselves fully. And when we do that, we do it like God does. We give ourselves to a diverse community. So it isn't that we give ourselves to the people who are like us. Mm-hmm. We give ourselves to a diverse community. Now, it's going to include people who are like us, but it's going to include people who are different than us, who are different ages, who are different, come from different backgrounds, who have different ways of looking at the world, all of that. We commit ourselves to giving ourselves fully to that kind of a community where we learn how to give ourselves fully so that we can go out and give ourselves fully. Our community is to be a community that is magnetic, that people say, wow, look at how they love one another. And that would be the last thing I would say we look at right now. I would say the world would say, definitely not.
Interesting, because I just listened to a podcast this morning that was talking about how privilege is attached to hopelessness. That, like, what you're talking about is, like, a very hope-filled thing, yes. But, like, because of the privilege that we all experience, it actually leads us to a magnetic attraction to hopelessness.
Yes.
Wow. Because of all of the choices we have. And I was just thinking about it because I graduated from college in 2009. Wow. So you're like, article was talking about 2009 and just like, I mean, I have a really hard time of putting myself in people's shoes, but I was thinking about it. I was like, well, all my friends were that way too. Like I think my generation has like really never interacted with each other in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then I think, and then just connecting it to what I was listening to this morning of like hopelessness, because we have all these other avenues. That's kind of the mark too of when like we had all of these choices, and with all choice, like there is literally nothing else you have to put your like life into. And that's what I was talking about. Like you have nothing to solidly put your life into. You can grasp onto hopelessness. Right. Everything right. feels hopeless.
Right. Right.
And there is no hope in that. So, sorry.
No, I think that was a good point. And I do think that talks about community is where we put our lives into. And I'm going to be real honest with you. I don't see community. I very rarely. I mean, we have some like small groups and things like that. That's I've very, very rarely seen it as community. Every once in a while, I do. But this is what he's talking about as far as community. Resisting hoarding your life. Resisting considering your life first and then others. Because mm-hmm. Philippians says the opposite, right? Consider others' interests first. Their others' needs first. We give generously of our time, of our resources. We give, and this is all from James 1. This is how God gives. We give without shaming. In other words, we don't have strings attached when we give. So I don't, and when I say strings attached, we rarely give to people and say, now, just so you know, I'm expecting something back. But where do we do that? In our heads, right? Mm-hmm. Right? We give, and maybe even when we're giving, we don't say it. But 2 months down the road, we're going, boy, I did so much for them. And there's nothing. Like, yes, exactly, exactly. Remember, God's not transactional. He doesn't give himself fully to us and then say, all right, what are you giving back to me? That's how he expects us to give in community, so that we don't give in order to get back. It's not a tit-for-tat kind of a thing. And we give without partiality. And whoever God brings to us, we give whatever of ourselves.
And we give joyfully. Too,
and we give joyfully, right? Yeah, right, right, exactly.
It's not about you. Yeah. It's just like, great, I can just do this for God, or for, you know,
it's, yeah,
make it about me.
And we can only do that, though. We can only. Where does joy come from?
Connection.
Secure attachment, right? Mm-hmm. Connection with whom?
God and others.
So unless I've been practicing God's story is my story, I'm not going to be able to practice in community God's story. I won't be able to bring the joy. And so if I've not practiced God's story is my own, I will come into community and then do it as an obligation. And I won't be joyful, right? Because mm-hmm. And you'll, depending on your personality, you might be able to do it for a long time, but at some point the resentment comes in, right? Mm-hmm. I can't believe I've been doing this for years and no one has ever. Mm-hmm. You hear yourself saying that mm-hmm. and you know, whew, go back. God's story is your story. Where's the joy? The joy comes from attachment from him. And you get to give that attachment out. What is it? So I'm going to ask you this. What does it feel like for you to, or what does it look like for someone to hoard their life? You give me some ideas.
I would say not having any margin in your life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Not having margin in your life.
Not having
margin in your life.
What do you mean?
In other words,
time. That your life isn't like every single minute is scheduled so that when something comes up, you can't give yourself and help someone else out.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's a big one. That means you've hoarded your life. In other words, you've packed your life so full of the stuff you want to do that you have no time when things come up. And life is messy. Things come up every day, right? So if you've packed your life like that, you've hoarded it. You've said it's all about me planning, and now things happen, and now your plan goes awry, and now you get angry, right? So you've put yourself in that circle. So that's definitely one big thing about hoarding your life. What else? What other kinds of things would your life look like? Isolation. Yes. How so, Karen?
Well, I think of myself in isolation of like, then I'm not connecting to anybody if I'm isolating. So
right.
It's kind of like, I think we can kind of fake it or like convince ourselves if we're busy that we're connecting with people. Mm-hmm. But in isolation, I mean, it's literally just you and nothing else.
Yep.
And whatever fakeness too, that you're either putting up with the TV or a phone or book or, you know, not that all of that is bad, but like you are totally
right. So isolating would be another big thing that you're hoarding your life. And I definitely have dealt with this. I mean, off and on, but these last couple of months, I have hoarded my life in that I have said, well, my schoolwork is just coming to a close and I just got to really, and so I isolate myself and I justify it. Just like you said, I justify it to say, well, I've got to do this. Well, who says?
Well, I do it because I'm like, oh, I'm busy.
Right. I'm so busy. No, myself. I can't do this.
No, it's really interesting because I read something, it was a while ago, about how we say we're really busy, so we need to be home at night. But actually, if we engage with other people and do something outside of your home with other people, we actually get more energy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Remember, a brain cannot integrate without another brain. Mm-hmm. So
it goes against what we want to do is to pull back and be private, but what we need is other people.
Yeah.
Being the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
At what point are you beating yourself up or judging yourself? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that I think that's a good question. And I think this is why people don't like James. Because James says there's good in beating yourself up to an extent, right? It's why the church for most centuries has had a liturgical calendar so that there are times, right? What's this 40 days right now is Lent. Yeah. It's the time for a better term, beating yourself up. But then comes Easter, right? And you live in the joy. So in the church calendar year, there are times to do this. And then most of the time is joyful. So I think that's a really good point to bring out is this isn't every day. This isn't all the time. But yes, you do have to spend time mourning where you've been, mourning the story. So I think that's a good thing.
But in your case, you have a legitimate.
It's not legitimate. I know it's not legitimate. And you know, and you know why I know.
Get done.
But you know what? This for me. For me, it means I have to. I am spending probably four times the amount of time I need to spend on something because I want it to be perfect, so that I have straight A's. So, and guess what? When I do that, I eliminate time with others. Now, and I know there are people in my class who don't spend near the much amount of time that I do. And they're as far as I, and here's what I know. They just came out with any graduates in the graduate school who are eligible for the Honor Society. Guess what? Everyone in my class is. The whole class. So that tells me my time is not legitimate that I'm using. Because I know how much time some of them spend. So it's not legitimate. And I am very careful to not, I will rationalize it, but then I can hear God saying.
But what if you were the only one left off the list?
Well, that's the, like, so? What's the point? So right. You're trying to.
No one asks that one after you've got your graduate. After you graduate.
No, they don't.
Right. Then where were you? Where
was your goal to be in the Honor Society? Right. Here's your goal to
learn.
You know, learn
exactly.
You share.
Exactly.
The gospel.
Yes.
Well, and
exactly.
You're going to learn from other people. You're missing
yes.
the opportunity
yes.
to learn from somebody else that God has yeah. provided for you.
I know.
And you, how many times have I done that? How many times have I
yeah.
squandered an opportunity
yep.
because I wanted something else?
Yes,
right.
Exactly. Exactly. So there is a point in your life that you have to be harsh with yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to be honest. Is she acting
Bye.
Like Elsa?
She's like, hey, writing all over.
She's
going to her throne.
So, Jill, I have to share a
yeah.
story from last week.
Yes.
So last week, my son Ryan was in the hospital with migraines, and we were in the city, so we felt very isolated, but yet not, because we had friends who were surrounding us in prayer. But you still feel physically isolated.
Yes.
And but we had friends who came to visit us too, also. So, so not entirely, but there were long, it was 9 days, and there were long times when we were, where the two of us felt isolated. And there was this man that I saw the first day we were there, and just could see the pain in his face from his migraines. And God just, you know, told me to start praying for him. I had no idea who he was or what his name was. And Ryan and I sat next to him for like a minute between some appointments that we both had. And introduced ourselves. So I had a name to go with my prayers. And Ryan had a very difficult day that I could not no longer help him. Like, he was angry, he wanted to go home, he was had been through quite a bit, and wouldn't even eat, you know, had kind of shut down. And so I sat there in his room, ate for myself, and just prayed, you know, for God's help. And he gave me an idea to find this man in the hallway, and ask him if he plays chess, of all things, because that's something that's a big thing for Ryan. So I couldn't eat my dinner fast enough. In fact, I left half of it off the tray, because my excuse to get down the hall was to take the tray. And so I get into that long hallway, because we're at the end, and there's nobody there. And I thought, okay, God, I'm listening, but, you know, I'm not going to wake this man up, because he's in pain as well, you know?
Yeah.
So I come all the way down the empty hallway, thinking, okay, I'll see him on the way back in. Well, before I even got to the end of the hall, he turns the corner and he's right there.
Mm.
And so I asked him, you know, tried to create community so we weren't isolated. And in tears, asked him if he could play chess. And he's like, and of course he played chess because he got it, you know. Like. So I kind of knew the answer before I asked him. But so I invited him into our room, and he gave Ryan things that I could never give him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
how does this medication work? How does your pain
mm-hmm.
feel? When does
mm-hmm.
this happen? How does, you know, like... Ryan is not a real outgoing social kid, and I saw a whole different side of him.
Exactly.
And he laughed, and the first thing Ryan said to me is, Mom, that was really great. Thanks for inviting him in.
Aww.
And then he said, you could have beat him in chess. It wasn't about the chess game. It was, it was about the conversation. This is not a kid who converses. So to see that community, and then the interesting thing was, his name was Larry. He had very, very difficult days following that, where he was not, like, that was the kind of like the only time we saw him out of his pain as well. So Ryan made a point of going into his room a couple of times after that to wish him well and to connect with him and let him know how much he had given Ryan. And so even in Ryan's pain and in our struggle, we were trying to give back to this man who was kind to spend an hour and a half on the one day that he felt like better.
Wow.
And just to see how much he struggled after that was heartbreaking to Ryan. And here he was still in pain, Ryan. And mm-hmm. but was empathizing and mm-hmm. trying to do for him what he had done for
yes,
Ryan. But
yeah.
Ryan, like, we didn't have the capacity to necessarily do that fully like he did. So, but community was so important. And community with somebody who could give my son something
uh-huh. that you couldn't. Uh-huh. That you couldn't. And to be able to give that up, right? Especially his mom, because we want
right.
to do everything.
And that's what I told him in the hall. I'm like, he needs somebody else, and it's not me now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's a great story, Donna. It's a great story.
Thank you. Thank you. I didn't
need
to take
more time. No, that was a perfect story, and that's exactly how James feels about community is we can give one another something that other people can't give, and that's to see the value in that is so important that we don't hoard our lives. And obviously Larry did not hoard his life. Even in his pain, he didn't hoard that hour and a half that was he could have just sat and been grateful that he didn't have as much pain as before, but he chose it to be with Ryan, and then Ryan could do that with him. This is what God is talking about, is when we give ourselves fully and we give ourselves to community, and that we begin to practice giving ourselves to community. In that, he says, he talks about the fact that we need to be patient. Because right after he talks about the rich man who hoards his life, then he says, be patient. Why do you think he says be patient when he's asking us to give our lives fully?
Because we want to, do something with it. Like,
right,
we wanna, like,
right, right. We expect when we give our lives fully that the persons we're giving, the people that we're giving our lives to, they're going to immediately, right?
And
yeah, accept it and
no,
love
right,
it and, like,
right,
all
yeah.
of a sudden we change, right? as if that's what happened to us. It isn't. God has been patient with us, and so he says, you be patient with your brother's ability to accept your life and be able to accept attachment and attention. So being patient means that you, like James says, are a farmer, that you're actually planting attention and attachment. But when you plant, I mean, we've planted stuff in this class before. It takes a while, right? You just, yeah, you have to take care of, yeah. Some people didn't like that.
No, we just failed it.
We killed a lot of them.
But planting attachment and attention is not a one-day miracle grow thing. It's you plant it and then you wait, right? And part of that waiting is that you persevere under the trial. And it's a trial sometimes when we're giving our lives fully and the other person isn't either accepting it or we just feel like we're the ones giving all the time, that's a trial for us. But that trial, that persevering in a trial, means we expose ourselves to that. We become vulnerable, and we allow that, but we allow the patience that it's going to take for... Because what good does it do in community if you give yourself fully one day, and the person doesn't respond like you want to, and then you say, well, forget it. Well, what has happened to community there? It's destroyed, right?
Yeah.
It's more broken. Yeah, so the patience in community is a big, big deal. That we make sure that we are patient with not complaining about the other person's fruit not coming forward.
Because then we're reinforcing shame.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, you aren't
exactly.
worthwhile.
Yep.
And...
yep. Yeah. So, and sometimes our shame stories are so... overwhelming, that in order to even break through a little bit, it's going to take a long time. And every time you give up on that person, it's just reinforcing that. Mm-hmm. Exactly what Robin said. It just reinforces, well, see, I'm not worth it. I'm not valuable. People don't want to connect with me. That's what James wants us to know. To strengthen our hearts means to turn toward the direction of the Lord's coming, so that we're looking at, look, I'm wanting to... share this with as many people as possible, and not complain about how long it's taking them. Remember that we're translators of God's story, and that our translation of God's story is critical to others. And in that patience, to be sure that the Lord is being compassionate and merciful to us in the middle of that. So what he says is it's not so much about us showing compassion and mercy. We will, as we're living in God's story, but to continue to remember and practice his compassion and mercy toward us, because we're going to need that as we live within community. The last piece that James talks about, and this is dear to my heart. He talks in verse 12, above all, brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. We've talked about this before, but I want to hit this again. What he's talking about there is that you are committed to others. That you are, when you make a commitment, you don't make a commitment to an event. You make a commitment to a person or to people, to a group of people. This is what community means. We tend to think that our commitments are all toward events, right? You come to this Bible study, so you've committed to come to the Bible study rather than come to the group. You've committed to do certain things, and it's to those certain events. What James says is, if you're living God's story, you're actually making commitments to people, not to events, not to do things, but to be with people. And that's a big paradigm shift for us, particularly in a society that's all about doing. It's all about doing rather than being with. He really wants us to do this. So that when he says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, what he means by that is when you make a commitment to do something, you're making a commitment to people, and your yes is, I'm committed to you. Mm-hmm. Not, I'm committed to coming to this place when it doesn't interfere with other stuff I have. But I'm committed to the people here. So that when I come, I'm coming so that I can connect and relate. It's great that you get to, if you're coming here, that you're learning with one another, but I'm committed to this. Now, this means a couple of things. When you're committed to a community, you can't be committed to too many communities, right? Mm-hmm. So, like Angela said, it requires then you not making too many commitments. It also means that you prioritize your commitments, right? So that your family is your first community, right? But the church is the second community. And the church means any group of believers that are coming together to honor God's name. Those commitments you honor first. In honoring those commitments to saying, I'm committed to these people, and unless something comes up that I can't possibly make it, I'm here because my commitment is to people. When my commitment is to events, who's the commitment really to?
Myself.
Mm-hmm. So that's a huge difference, and we don't think in those terms. We usually think the commitments we make are to ourselves. I'm committed to doing this, this, and this because these are the things I want to do. And so that when I have other things to do, it's only a choice between myself here or here. Rather than a commitment, I've made a commitment to these people. That looks a little different, right? Mm-hmm. Than if it's just to an event. And James is very adamant about that because James is all about it being about community, being about relationship. That's God's language. God's language isn't about events.
I was just thinking, it is ludicrous to flip it and say, like, Jesus was, you know, had his schedule, he had an appointment with the cross.
Exactly. That's a really good analogy. Yeah. I like that.
When I was thinking time too, I think we have this idea in our head that like we just have to be committed to like a season.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think, and maybe I'm just thinking about that as like I'm in the transition of like, well, I've committed this amount of time
mm-hmm.
to something where it's like not necessarily an event, but it's like, well, I've committed this,
mm-hmm.
and that's all.
Right.
And then it comes to the end of that commitment, and then I like.
Right.
Reevaluate or whatever, and then it's. But I think we think about that in seasons too, of like kind of like what you were saying. It's like, oh, that's like it's ludicrous to think that Jesus was just thinking of like, oh, well, this is this season, and this is this season.
Right.
Like, I don't
right.
think that he did that, but no. We really think like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly.
Well,
and that's all. That's what James is all about, right?
Yeah.
To have an integrated faith and an integrated life, we can't compartmentalize in any areas of our lives. And that means that everything is about relationship, that everything is about being committed to to being with people. Remember, that's the greatest need human beings have, right? To have somebody be with them, to belong. Yes, Chris.
You know how we, in our study a while back, we talked about going into a store and, saying that person's name who's checking us out and all of that. And, that's something that I've continually tried to practice. And what was interesting was last week I was, just going around with that in mind and thinking about everything is about connection. And, so here I am really trying to practice this. And I'm in line at a store, and before I had the chance, the woman across from me was checking me out went, "Oh, is that your grandchild?" that was on my phone, because I had laid my phone up. "Is that your grandchild?" And I was like, "Oh, yes. Do you see pictures?" "Oh, yeah." She's engaging me.
Yes.
And it was, I left there, and there was like a lightness to my step. I felt so
yes.
I went, "Oh, that was really sweet that God gave me a picture of what I'm trying so hard to focus on."
Right, right.
He let me experience how really awesome that does make you feel.
Yeah.
It made my day. This woman sat there and wanted to see every picture of my grandchild.
That's awesome, right? And that should be happening, right? Every time we are in here. That should be happening in here, right? We should be engaging with one another and committed to one another to actually look at one another's value to this community. It's actually the why I decided to have class this morning. Rob and I went back and forth, are we going to have class tomorrow? I was going to cancel. And I was feeling well enough, and I thought, I have a commitment to these people. And I really felt like, okay, these people weren't going to be here, but these people are going to be here. Mm-hmm. I want to switch my focus to these people I have a commitment to. And I feel really strongly about that.
Did we make you feel better?
Yes. And I always knew that.
And I was like, God's got you, and you're still valuable, even if you can't be in class.
I know.
It's okay.
I know. I had to work through. It's not about my having to teach. It's about all of you and what all of you mean. And that has been, I've shared a number of times the hard times that I've had with community where I haven't been valued. And it's been so devastating that I never want to be on that side. I never want to be on the side where I'm not valuing. And sometimes it's hard for me because in a class with this size, I don't get to talk to everyone. And there are times where I decide in the morning, okay, I haven't talked to this person forever. I'm going to talk to that person. And I don't get to. And I feel badly about that. But I think that's what community is about, right? There's no greater joy for me that when I finish teaching and everyone gets up and they're mingling around, that like everyone's engaged with one another. Mm-hmm. I stand back and look and I think, that's what this is about. That everyone engages and begins to care for one another's needs, sees one another as valuable. That's a huge piece. If all you did was come here, listen, and leave, you might get a lot of information, but you get nothing that backs it up.
Oh, but all these stories.
Yeah.
Donna's story.
Yes.
Chris's story.
Those are huge, right?
It's amazing.
Being vulnerable, sharing, letting yourselves be being fully known, those are big deals.
And you think about those afterwards, too. Or they can help. When I go through my week, like, oh, I remember her sharing that story. I feel the same struggle that she's feeling.
Right.
Or whatever it might be.
Exactly. Exactly. And I have also known, and this is the privilege as a teacher, I know that there have been times when people have gone home and said, I think I need to call her and tell her I've gone through the same thing or ask for advice or whatever. That's really been encouraging to hear that. And sometimes it's like, I didn't get to be in on that. But what's really nice is, there's connections outside so that it becomes a community. That's what James wants us to do. James wants us to see that we are not, that we don't go to church, that we don't go to Bible study, that we don't go to whatever communities we're involved in, that we don't go as an informational meeting and then leave it. That we're actually coming to people. Robin?
I'm struggling a little bit with you saying that our family should be our first priority and then the church our second. Because I feel like, Jesus said, who is our mother and our brothers and our sisters? And I feel like most of us very naturally care for our families and spend time with them. And you know, church people who are people that are like us. So I'm struggling with that.
No, I think, Robin, you're right. I think that's a good correction to make. And I think it's a hard one to, how do you delineate that? Mm-hmm. Where do you go? Because we don't, I mean, Scripture does talk about you can't ignore your, like, right, the Pharisees would say, oh, this money is Corban. This is dedicated to God, not to you. I'm not going to take care of you. Mm-hmm. So he warns us about not taking care of our family. Mm-hmm. But he also says, like Jesus says, who is my mother and father? Those who believe in me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a balancing act, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, as with everything, it's listening to God and
yes.
going and
yeah.
doing as he calls. But I just think most of us, and especially suburban women, you know, probably...
Yes.
take care of our families too much.
And I would agree with that. Yeah. So there would be times where, well, you know, my son really just wanted to go out and get some pair of jeans. So is that taking care of him? Mm-hmm. You know, or, you know, he's got a lot of studying to do, so he doesn't have to do any chores.
That's or it just needs to be our family.
Right.
You know, whereas if we're going to model compassion and reaching out and building friendships
yes.
with
yes.
people that aren't just like us.
Right.
Then I think, I don't know.
Yeah,
more often
I agree.
Than not, we need to.
It's very connected, though. It is.
Yeah, yeah, like I was just thinking that, like, how better to be an example to your children of what it looks like to live in community when you're out in community.
Right.
Like, I just replied to an RSVP because I was not going to go to this event because I'm like, oh, I should be at home with mom and have some mom time. And I was like, she would actually enjoy this event. So I was like, get us 2 tickets. You know, like, we're going out when our first reaction is stay home.
Yes.
I'm
yes.
busy, so
yes.
I should have some home time.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah.
So to interact.
Yeah.
And that's not an example that covers all
no.
things.
And, yeah, and it doesn't mean that you say yes to every connection mm-hmm. that there is. I mean, that's, Jesus always drew away, right? Mm-hmm. Withdrew. So these are always... like you said, you have to be in God's story, and you have to be
mm-hmm.
speaking to him every day about that. James's emphasis is community.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying this because he's talking to a culture that community isn't the norm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to a culture that community is not the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that concept you're talking about with the margin? You know, if you don't have any margin, you're not going to say... Yes, and because you're so busy, you're just
right.
going to be so exhausted at night that you're just going to want to sit in your
right.
house and just
mm-hmm. right.
be so overwhelmed. So if you have a little more margin or you pick and choose a little more of what you do, then you can be open to those invitations more often. And
right,
more,
right,
you know,
exactly,
so.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's like it's there are mornings when I wake up already planning my nap.
Yes.
And it's like anything else in life. You just take a longer nap somewhere else.
Right.
And we always talk about that at work. And just always, and there's a lot of different community where I work.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's the consumer side of it, and then there's
right.
the co-worker side of it.
Right.
So, you know, it's, I enjoy it because there's, but then I pull away from it in some ways because it's like there's too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always fun to hear stories that you're not invited to because of the conversations that are so loud. So you tend to kind of look over there because you just want to see who it is that's telling the story, and you try to get a picture of why the story
mm-hmm.
that they're telling and what else comes with it.
Yes.
So, yeah. And then you just kind of go, oh, my brain there.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so...
You're right about being energized, being with community, because yesterday I was in concert all day, so I was concert closed and all that stuff, you know. I left the house at 10, got home at 5, quick threw something in the oven, and I'm thinking, why did I commit to going to missions gathering? I committed to doing that, and I want to go. And I went, and it was just so exciting to see people that we'd gone to Ethiopia with, and then they just came back again from Rwanda and Ethiopia, and there was a Rwanda man there.
Yeah.
Pat heard him
Sunday
earlier.
Night.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And oh my word, how God spared this man is just a story within itself. It's just amazing. And I'm thinking, you know, how much God loves this man who, you know, was spared from all this genocide and all this junky stuff that we've never had to even think about. And I get home and there's a message on the phone from my neighbor. Could you please bring a flashlight and come over and help me find my baby chick? It got out.
Oh, and here we are. I'm 9 o'clock. I'm tired. I want to go home and go to bed. So my husband and I are tramping around the woods with flashlights looking for this little baby chick, you know. She said, oh, I'm so stupid. I'm so dumb. I didn't think it would get out, you know. And she had another one. She said, it's clucking around and it's missing its... his friend, it's just, and I'm thinking, okay, Lord. And she said, please pray, and I've been praying. I called a friend of mine, asked her to pray, and I called somebody else, and I said, I know you don't pray, but please pray. So we were tramping around, and was here, it is 10, 3, quarter, 11. We didn't find the chick, so we went home, and she said, oh, you're the best, God. Thank you for caring, and thank you for the hug, and blah, blah, blah. She called me at 8 o'clock this morning. And I said, you found the chick. I was out this morning, and I found the chick. And it was right where, not too far from where we had parted ways last night. But she said, oh, I'm just so thankful, you know, that God. And I said, that was such a wonderful story for your child who was just heartbroken, you know, to this answer to prayer. And this kid's in junior high, and I said, God actually answered this. You know, he cares for all of the little needs in our life. And it's just, you know, amazing how it all came together. But I was so energized by all of that, you know, that I forgot all about not being so tired.
Yes.
But you're right. It is energizing, and yeah. especially when God's part of it.
Yes, definitely. Part of the other thing about community is that we're looking at after each other's needs. So I think we see that in here. I've seen that a lot. But just things that get left here, like the napkins in the bathroom. Who left those, by the way? Is anybody going to tell me? I love those. Those are so pretty. People have left coffee and cream, and they just leave it and just kind of see to our needs here, which I really enjoy. But when you participate here, when you are asking questions, because that always helps, right? There's rarely been somebody that asks a question that many people aren't going, oh, I'm so glad they asked that question because I had the same question. Uh-huh. That helps to meet other people's needs as well. And words of encouragement. I've heard people encourage people. I've heard people encourage me. I've always appreciated also words of accountability. You know, to say that either that's not true or you need to be thinking of it a different way or, well, could it be seen something else? Mm-hmm. All of those are part of community. Being vulnerable, being open and honest, and being willing to be fully known. So that when you share your stories, that's huge for people. That's huge to help other people to be able to get to know you a little better. And to get to know different perspectives. And that was really the whole overarching thing for James is when we let God's story be our story, we allow his perspective to be our perspective. So when I'm sitting in those meditations and I see that God loves me so much, then I begin to understand I walk around the world not with this heavy shame on me, but this lightness, kind of what Chris had said before. And when I am involved in community, and I'm giving myself fully, and others are giving themselves fully to me, I get to see their different perspectives that I wouldn't have otherwise. Like, what is it like to be Cindy? When Cindy shares with me some of her life story, then I get to see what it's like to be Cindy, which is very different. I mean, Cindy has lost a son. And I think about that so many times, and I think, how do we look at other people? They went through something like that too. So that her perspective is something I don't have, but I need, right? I need that perspective. And I need the perspectives of all of you who've told me stories that's just been helpful for me to see the world in a different way. It helps me teach as well, so that I know, like, these are the things that people have gone through These are the places where they have pain and wounds. So that what James wants us to understand is that when we do this, when we come into community with God's story and we're living God's story, we're able to keep each other accountable about living God's story. We do this and we create then space for the joy in attachment. So that there's great joy. It's not just, so last night I wasn't in class because I was sick, and it was really hard for me not to be in class.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was this, oh, I don't get to be in class. Mm-hmm. And one of the members of our class actually is on the verge of his wife having a baby. So he wasn't in class as well, and they Skyped him in. Oh. And I did think, I don't want to be Skyped in. But then I thought, probably not a good idea. Sick. But the joy that you get from being with the people
mm-hmm.
is mm-hmm. Immense, and that stays with you. That's what that James wants us to know about community and God's story is that joy. We create the space for joy. And it might not come right away. It might take a long time. It's going to take patience, and it might take a while for you to connect. Depending on, you know, if you're an introvert, it's going to take a longer time for you to connect, right? But you will. You will connect. If the group is committed to being community with God's story, then there will be connection.
Oh, and Jill, you yeah. asked me to remind you to share about something you had to wait on in your community in your class.
Oh, so remember I told you the story about one member of our cohort mm-hmm. who decided that she was not going to walk yeah. with us in graduation oh, yeah. because right. it was yeah. wrong. Mm-hmm. So I went in to class the next day and I said, you know, I just want you to know I will really miss you there. I'm just really sad that that's the decision that you've made. And she said, oh, that was all she said. And I thought that was a weird, like she didn't say anything except that. The next week she came into class and she said, oh no, she wrote an email to everybody. I just want everyone to know that I have capitulated and I'm going to walk with you all. But one of the other members said, you didn't capitulate, you decided to be with us as a group.
Awesome. All
right. Really?
That was pretty cool, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
She actually did see. But I think it just took one person to say,
yeah.
oh, you know, we're going to miss you. This is sad. Rather, and it began to make me think, I wonder if underneath it all, she needed that. She yeah. wanted people to say, yeah. we'll miss you.
Mm-hmm. But you were mad at the beginning.
I was mad. I was mad. And because I felt like yeah. she wasn't choosing us. Yeah. She was choosing the right thing
but
to
you
do.
You gave her what story. You wanted. Yeah. Like, in a way, you gave yeah. her what you wanted.
Exactly.
To.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's I thought cool. that was a... it was really fun to see mm-hmm. that yeah. that's how community can be.
Yeah.
And I almost didn't say anything to her. And part of it was because I was mad. Like, I don't want it to come out that way. And I had to be very careful to say, I just will miss you. And I, you know, part of me wanted to teach. Part of me wanted to say, really? Now, I bet you understand.
But you did.
I know.
Yes. This is so funny.
Yes.
You did teach.
I know.
Yes.
So, community means something to everybody, even if you don't think it means it to somebody, mm-hmm. even if they seem like they're not connecting, or it does mean it is our most essential need that we belong. So in 4:17 he says to know the right thing to do and not do it is sin. And to know the right thing to do is always relationship. It's always relationship, always relationship. That's what God's about. So that if we, that's how we deal with anger, is we begin to allow God's story to overwhelm our story and to become our story. Let him bury our story and let his story be ours. And in doing that, we come into community where we're each trying to do that, that we're each helping one another to bury those shame responses. And so that at some point, we become so familiar with one another that we're able to keep each other accountable. When I start judging and you say, Jill, you're judging, that's a good thing. Now, I know that that is also a tough thing to do, particularly in our society. We don't like that, right? We don't like people telling us. But in the Christian community, we are supposed to do that. But we do have to get to a point where if I've been open enough with you and you've been open enough with me, that we can do that, that we can call each other to account where we've been off, where we've been telling Satan's story and not our own. Or not God's. So that we, what happens is, instead of, you've heard this phrase, hurt people, mm-hmm. now it's wounded healers, I wrote this somewhere, wounded healers heal others. That's what James is getting to, is we have been healed. Are we actually allowing God to continue to heal our story so that we can bring that to others as well? So that there's joy in attachment in community with God's story. And then people can be free to create and be image bearers that translate God's words and emotions well. So,
first story. Wounded healers.
Yeah.
Your story of your Donna.
Yes.
I'm sorry. That's exactly.
That's exactly what it was.
And isn't that AA?
Yeah. That's exactly what that is, right? Yeah. That's exactly what it is. So this rarely happens. 5 minutes before we're supposed to end, we're done. Because we have a week off, is there anything that has been bothering you that you don't get, that you wanted to comment on, that we need to? We have one more week, and the whole last chapter 5 is on prayer. So we're going to talk about prayer in community, which is really for James, is the big deal.
Jill, there was one thing last week. When you were going through the notes about fighting adultery, judging self-sufficiency, you did not say how God counters the hostility of self-sufficiency.
Oh, yeah.
So you were very good about giving how God counters in the first three, but because that was beginning at the end of the class, you skipped ahead and you left that one blank, and that has bothered me all week.
Just because you asked.
He counters the hostility by saying that our life is sustained and kept by him, his will only. That he keeps us, that he sustains us in our life, not us. Does that make sense? That our life continues only because he wills it, not because we do. Anybody else have any questions or comments or? Yes, Jane.
I kept tripping over the word filthiness, which is.
Yes.
So I finally got out Webster.
Uh huh.
And the usual definitions: foul, with, disgusting, dirty, vulgar. Can't read my writing. Obscene. And then I came across abundantly supplied, as in filthy rich.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this over amount thing. I think some of the Greek says something to do with the buildup of wax in your ear.
I'm not being able to hear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That's good, Jane. I'd like you to take a few minutes. Close your eyes, come before the Lord. Before we confess. Merciful God, come before you. Sorry.
We confess
we
have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry, and we humbly repent. For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and forgive us, that we may delight in your will and walk in your ways
to the glory of your name. Amen.